Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 24th of July. Coming up on the program is a new political era of cooperation sweeping through Johannesburg. Former Minister Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi on the National Dialogue proposal, why Malmesbury and Wellington's property market in the Western Cape is booming, and strong words of advice for the new Environment Minister. Reports are emerging that Johannesburg's Al Jamaa mayor, Kabelo Gwamanda, is about to lose office. And it seems there is a new spirit of cooperation between the ANC and Action SA. I'm joined now by the party's Michael Beaumont. Mr. Beaumont, welcome to you. And what then has prompted your party to consider working with the ANC? Previously, you said you'd never do it.
Well, I think we've got a crisis on our hands in Johannesburg, and we need to be clear about that because the largest political parties are not providing any leadership to our city. The ANC has installed a mannequin as a mayor for all intents and purposes. And the DA has refused on no less than four occasions to reinstate the former coalition that once existed under Mpho Palatse. Action SA is engaging our constituents who are saying, you can't continue to sit on your 44 pairs of hands. In Johannesburg, you are the third largest party. You need to develop a solution. And we feel that we've developed a solution that remains true to the principle that we are not entering a coalition or co-governing with the ANC. But on the other hand, we can dictate terms to the benefit of the residents of Johannesburg. And that's what we're seeking to do here.
So it's maybe not a coalition, but it certainly would appear to be a shift in strategy. How do you justify this to your supporters?
Well, I think there's a few ways. The most important of which, Jeremy, is the world we've awoken to after the 29th of May is a world in which voters expect political parties to work together in their interests, and that perhaps less important than which configuration of parties are delivering services is the question of the services being delivered. In this particular environment, the previous position of Action SA to say we can't work with the ANC has proven to be one that will operate to the detriment of our residents going forward. And we face the question, do we hold on to a position stubbornly for the sake of saying, you know, we haven't changed, or do we do what's right for the residents of Johannesburg? And I think we've chosen the latter, knowing that if the residents see value in what we are producing in this role, ultimately, doing what's right for them will involve them doing what's right for us in the future elections.
And predicated, I understand, on two key demands. One is around the electricity tariff. The second, as you've referred to, is the departure of the mayor. Have you had positive affirmation from the ANC that this is going to happen?
Without any question, they have affirmed it is going to happen. But obviously, saying it's going to happen and it happening are two different things. And what's good about the strategy that we have followed is we've now put the ball in their court. If they choose not to do it, that is their right. But as to is our right not to offer our support going forward until those conditions have been met. But simultaneously, there are other conditions as well, Jeremy, including in which is Action SA bringing a series of motions to the council that drive a legislative agenda of service delivery in the city of Johannesburg. Service delivery has atrophied, and infrastructure collapse in particular has created a water crisis in our city over which our mayor has presided with seemingly no opinions whatsoever. These things have to change, and part of the arrangement is that Action SA will bring motions to council that force government to address these issues.
And what is on top of that list of motions, Michael?
Well, at the very top is the water crisis in Johannesburg. There are too many communities, as we speak, who live day to day uncertain of whether water will be supplied. Water has become the new load shedding for the people of the city. But let's be frank, you can throw a rock and hit an issue of service delivery failure in Johannesburg. The roads are falling apart. Refuse collection in many neighborhoods is causing refuse and filth to pile up. And certainly the inner city has gone back to a stage of returning to a slum. There has to be rejuvenation in the inner city, reclaiming of hijacked buildings. These are all vital elements that I think will form part of that legislative agenda.
Are there specific roles or positions that Action SA is expecting to secure in the Johannesburg Council through this cooperation?
Absolutely. The most important of which is the Speaker of Council. We will not enter the executive because we are not interested in co-governing with the ANC in the same way that the DA, IFP, and Freedom Front Plus are doing at a national level. We are going to enter through the legislature so that we can actually hold government to account. But the vital thing is when we have a Speaker of Council, Council no longer becomes the instrument that defends poor leadership in the executive, which is what it has been in the city of Johannesburg over the last few years. It becomes a real accountability instrument where councillors can go there on behalf of their residents and hold the executive to account in the manner that was intended in our constitution.
It is a paradigm shift, Michael Beaumont. This cooperation, for instance, what would it mean for your relationship with the DA in areas where you currently cooperate, like Tshwane?
Well, firstly, I think we need to be clear. The DA has chosen to go into a co-governance arrangement in the executive with the ANC and is currently debating how it can give the president a free pass on Pala Pala. So we do not anticipate much of an opinion from the DA on this matter. But that said, we remain part of a coalition agreement in the capital city, where we have communicated our commitment, our adherence to a coalition agreement. We will be working with our partners to defeat the motion of no confidence that the ANC are bringing this coming Thursday there. And as a matter of fact, we have a deputy mayor who's delivering great value. For example, clean water to the people of Hammanskraal for the first time in 18 years this September. So we will continue to work within that arrangement because our commitments in any of these places need to be about the residents more than the parties we are working alongside.
You were very emphatic that you were not going to go into the government of national unity, but could this cooperation in one way or another impact the broader national political landscape if this works in Johannesburg?
Not from a Action SA standpoint, it is our view that actually the model of a so-called government of national unity is a bad model because it results in the co-option of the opposition. Right now, 70% of parliament forms part of the government. And what that means is that the opposition space has been decimated. That's why you can now have the largest cabinet in South Africa's history, and there's absolute silence from those parties that formerly used to object to that. And that's why you can have political parties that are now saying the president should get a free pass on Pala Pala because the EFF have committed greater crimes outside of their coalition. These are all things that are of great concern when the opposition has all been taken up into positions of government. And we would venture that what we are putting on the table in Johannesburg is what should have happened nationally. There should have been a confidence and supply model that kept the opposition strong and in the legislature rather than being co-opted with blue lights and ministerial benefits.
And just finally, how would you address the possible backlash from your supporters regarding your cooperation with the African National Congress?
Well, I think any change of this nature requires a program of engaging, which we are currently well underway with. But certainly, it is our supporters in many instances that have said to us, we cannot have a 5-year term of office where all we have to show for it is how we sat on our hands. So I think the most important thing that we are receiving from our supporters is that they would support this arrangement if it delivers value for the residents. That's what it must be measured on, and that's the question that we are going to be seized by going forward, and that's what we want to be held accountable for in the next election.
Michael Beaumont, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A coalition of foundations has backed President Ramaphosa's call during his recent inauguration for a national dialogue on South Africa's socio-economic crises. Ramaphosa had called for this dialogue to, in his words, chart a collective vision for the country's future over the next 3 decades. Former struggle stalwart Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi says it's clear that South Africa is in a political crisis. She's my next guest on the Fix SA podcast, which drops on Friday.
Thank you and good afternoon, Jeremy. So this particular national dialogue very much came about through President Thabo Mbeki doing his 30-year reflections on the state of our democracy. And he outlined quite a number of issues. And it was very clear from that our country is in quite a difficult situation right now. And the intention was to look towards what we could do to really make a difference. How could we change this around? Because the one thing would be to lament the current reality, or we could take an approach that says we've got to do something about it. He addressed all the national foundations, and through that engagement, it was clear that as national foundations, we would make a call to all South Africans on a national dialogue in order that we could imagine and create the South Africa we want. So when I say we, it's not we as the national foundations. Our role was to make the call, but it's we, the people of South Africa, as captured in our constitution. We're in the process now of, through a small secretariat, pulling together what the key areas are. But you are aware through the dialogue, we had already identified some of those, and as well as the phases, you know, to conceptualize and plan what is required to take this forward, to look at the commencement and so on. But we're also very clear that it's not something that belongs to the national foundations. It's not something that we want to push separately. It's got to belong to the whole of government and to the whole of society. So ordinary people must see themselves as part of this and see what comes out of this process reflected in the national development plan.
Ideally, Geraldine, what should come out of the process?
Ideally, it should be one that deals with certain broad areas, the reality of inequality in South African society and how we'll overcome that, looking at growing our economy in order that we can deal with the whole issue of joblessness and unemployment, and it requires creative thinking. Thirdly, looking at national cohesion and how do we overcome what's seen as almost a brokenness in society, whether you talk about femicide, whether you talk about high levels of crime, and so on. And also being able to fix what has gone quite wrong in society as a whole. So that's what we'd like to see come out of it, in addition to everything else. I mean, we want to promote peace, security, democracy, socio-economic development, and so on. We'd want to even reflect on, you know, what should be the foreign policy outlook of our country. But that needs to be done through a structure outside of the national foundations. And here, some of the thinking is pointing towards a tripartite or a body that's been involved in compacting and social compacting. And that would be a structure such as NEDLAC and probably the NEDLAC Executive Committee, with a big challenge of bringing on board the voices of ordinary South Africans wherever they are.
Former struggle stalwart Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi. She's my next guest on the Fix SA podcast, which drops on Friday.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
My next guest says there are huge profits to be made in exploiting South Africa's natural resources, but they do come at a cost to society and the environment. Patrick Bond is Distinguished Professor at the University of Johannesburg's Department of Sociology, where he directs the Center for Social Change. Professor Bond, welcome to you. And firstly, then, why have you seen fit to raise this issue? And what advice are you giving to the new Environment Minister?
Oh, it's so nice to be with you and the listener, Jeremy. Probably not sounding a warning so much as retaining caution that an approach that Dion George's predecessor, Barbara Creasy, had adopted that didn't work. And that approach relies upon essentially the market system and technology to solve these vast socio-ecological and especially biodiversity and climate catastrophes that are unfolding. We're in a sixth great extinction. And as even indications such as the flooding in Cape Town or the rain bomb that hit Durban, we're really unprepared for extreme weather events. That's why I think the caution about whether the markets and technology come to the rescue is really appropriate, especially because Dion George is in China at the moment and he's adopting the BRICS policies in spite of DA opposition to some of the BRICS. They're working hand in glove with the Brazil, South Africa, India, China delegation to do exactly that, markets and technology as solutions instead of climate justice.
How does any government these days find the right balance between societal need on the one side and also responsible environmental and climate management?
Well, there's really four approaches, and the one that we're obviously worried about in terms of balance is a complete lack of balance, which is Donald Trump and climate denialism, and that appears very much to be ascendant, and there are plenty of other right-wing governments around the world that are basically turning away. A second approach, which I think Dion George and Barbara Creasy have adopted, is to adopt, let's say, a corporate agenda of new gas and, to some extent, oil, and potentially including some further development of South Africa's coal resources, but then to pretend that there are techniques in place to mitigate against the impact. The third is to actually go full carbon pricing and to use taxation to stop as many emissions as we can that are irrational and counter to the national and the continental and the world's interests. And the fourth is the climate justice, which suggests we should be turning away from both market and technology and really imposing through state will, as was done with the chlorofluorocarbons that were threatening the ozone hole, really impose emissions cuts and to do so with an equity lens, that is to make sure that women, low-income communities, people of color are not going to bear the burden since they, by and large, didn't cause the problem. So those four ideologies, hopefully we won't see Donald Trump in the White House, but with Biden stepping down, maybe things have changed in the calculus there. But there is certainly a climate denialism as witnessed in the hosting of this event, not only this year in Azerbaijan, oil petrostate, right? But also last year in the UAE, the year before in Egypt. And then we have, I think, where unfortunately Dion George has locked in. I was surprised, actually, that he's really uncritically adopted the sort of BRICS position, which is let the middle income or sub-imperial countries continue emitting as much as they like. He's made that very clear in his statement to the BASIC conference in Wuhan, China.
Professor Bond, let's pivot, if we can, from politics and policy maybe just to real impact. And how then do pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, as you've raised, disproportionately impact black and low-income communities in South Africa? Where specifically? And do you think it's getting worse?
Oh, absolutely. And anyone who witnessed the extraordinary rain, let me call them grenades, they kept hitting over the past week and a half in Cape Town and the Cape Flats. You know, the DA there running the city will probably say with some justification, yeah, but some of those houses that were flooded, the shacks, were basically the result of the COVID-19 land invasions. Do you remember in mid-2020 with a failure by national government to enforce the prohibition on evictions? There were plenty of evictions in townships, in Khayelitsha especially. Then there were something like 200 land invasions. And in those low-lying areas or in areas near rivers, or in the case of Durban in 2022, many shacks that climb up those rather steep hills. Well, they become very vulnerable when there's terrible rain, and the 500 people who died in Durban and the surrounds in April 12, 2022, 497, I only could find in all my research there, only three white middle-income fatalities. Every fatality is tragic, but it definitely is the case that on the question of flooding, our lack of stormwater drainage for low-income areas, the lack of decent housing, the bridges and roads that collapse, these reflect a failure to make our cities resilient. And then, of course, the rural areas are subject to the droughts. And in our case, a little bit, a couple of years ago, locust plagues. And that really has hit East Africa. I was in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam last week, and they were, especially Nairobi, if you go all the way out to Somalia, you find devastation in droughts. And then when the droughts end and there's flooding, also the locusts come and they ripped up the food system. So rural Africa definitely needs some adaptation in the form of better irrigation and food sovereignty instead of the cash cropping that's mostly what we do with agriculture in the continent.
Isn't economic development always, though, detrimentally going to impact environmental protection?
Yes, if we call it development, I would call it maldevelopment, Jeremy. And, you know, we're sitting here, you and I in Johannesburg, we're the epitome, aren't we? The world's most unequal city. And if you think back roughly 100 years, we were the city that had at peak half the world's gold reserves underneath us. And now what have we got? Zamazamas and big holes and acid mine drainage and all sorts of problems that have come from the simple draining. Instead of having reinvested, let's say the way Norway, which has vast amounts of oil, and about 30 years ago, they set up their oil fund to reinvest, a sort of sovereign wealth fund, and they take the proceeds and put them back into future generations' interests, whether that be education or financial assets that will grow over time or productive assets. And we've just simply not done that, have we? Most of our wealth from that vast amount of gold has frittered away or gone to London or to tax havens. And I think that's the essence of where Dion George has, I think, ultimately failed with an ideology that says, as he actually put it, I see through the lens of finance. And yet, as readers can do, because it's online, you can find his UNISA PhD on change, environmental change. There's nothing about natural environment. There's no attempt in his work to understand market failures, financial speculation bubbling, and the looting of our continent through resource depletion. That's really the worst aspect to me, Jeremy, of living in an Africa that is extraordinarily wealthy. We have $10 trillion. Dollars worth, $185 trillion in assets in natural resources still underground. But at this rate, when we're basically taking it out of the country and we're failing to find the reinvestment in higher education and other education that is human capital and also productive capital, our fixed investment rate is very low. That means our depletion of natural capital is devastating. So that's where I'd hoped to find Dion George, let me call him a financially conscious in the biggest sense that our resources include our natural resources. But I simply don't see that. And regrettably, as he's gone to China to do advocacy alongside Brazil, India, China, the basic group within the United Nations, he's basically locked into their agenda, which is to keep emitting and to never admit any climate debt, any ecological reparations that are due. So I'm, you know, already as disappointed as I projected in writing about this in the conversation which you've posted on MoneyWeb today. Thanks.
Professor Patrick Bond, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally, two locations in the Cape Winelands are emerging as new hotspots for property investors and lifestyle seekers. Attention turning to the areas of Wellington and Malmesbury, which offer a blend of affordability, natural beauty and growth potential. That's according to Mariki Spiss, who is MD of the estate agent Fine and Country in Stellenbosch. She joins me on the program now. And firstly, what factors make let's go with Wellington first, such an attractive destination?
So Wellington, I think for a long time has been the, let's call it the hidden secret of the Boerland. So it's in very close proximity to Stellenbosch and Paarl. It's 45 minutes from Stellenbosch, it's 50 minutes from Cape Town, 20 minutes from Paarl, but it still has that bit of a platteland charm. So you get the, still have the feeling with the farms around, you're surrounded by mountains. It's a beautiful town, but it's, you are still very close to everything. So it's becoming a great alternative to towns like Stellenbosch and Paarl, especially because of your price range. which is quite lower than both of those, but you still have a lot of the attractions that you get when you invest in Paarl and Stellenbosch.
Marijke, give me a sense of property values in that area right now.
The majority of properties that are on the market range between 2 million and 4 million, which is a nice price range for both investors, for first-time buyers. So very few of the properties go beyond 4 million and up. So it's a very nice price range to be operating in.
Is it also a sense that places like Stellenbosch and Paarl perhaps have become oversubscribed and property values there perhaps don't necessarily match with reality right now, or affordability is maybe a more tactful way of putting it?
Yes, I think affordability is a tactful way of putting it. Obviously, the property markets in Stellenbosch and Paarl is great. The values that you get there if you invest is really good, but for a lot of the buyers that are attracted by Wellington and surrounds, also Malmesbury for example, is attracted because it's affordable. Stellenbosch for example, for a young couple with two salary incomes, it's extremely expensive. So although it's a wonderful place to invest in, Wellington is a very nice alternative, being in the 2 million to 4 million bracket. So that is why it's becoming such a good alternative.
Give me a sense of why Malmesbury is also becoming popular.
Very much the same as Wellington, in the sense that it's also, you still have that platteland countryside feeling, but it's close to Cape Town. They've invested a lot to expand the N7 highway with two lanes in both directions to Cape Town. So it's a very nice alternative for people working in Cape Town, but who still want that lifestyle, bit of a countryside charm. Very good value for money in terms of pricing. And then things like also you've got good property rates, a very good functioning municipality. And then, of course, price range. It's very similar to Wellington in the sense that you get a lot of properties between 2 and 4 million, a lot of nice new developments, which is very good value for money. So in that sense, it's very similar to Wellington.
I also assume that the global shift to remote work would be influencing investment in places like Wellington and Malmesbury, which are perhaps geographically more distant from a main hub like Cape Town, but nonetheless, you can still get your work done there.
It surely is. So I am involved in residential development as well in Wellington, where we deal a lot with buyers. And a lot of the buyers, interesting enough, are attracted to these towns because they are able to work remotely. So one of the first things you often get asked is there good fiber? Because they come here to work. And it's something that wouldn't have been like that the past, let's say, 10 years ago. But now, given that people can basically work from anywhere, and a lot of people have the opportunity to do so, we get a lot of buyers that are attracted to both of these towns because they are able to work remotely. Even people from the north of the country, Johannesburg, Pretoria, they work for global entities sometimes, and they prefer to settle in these towns because they are able to do so, working remotely.
As far as these two centres are concerned, are the buyers people who have decided that Cape Town is no longer affordable, or as you put it, people from the north, myself included, would we be the people that are settling there, or is it a kind of combination of both?
It's a wide combination. So we closely monitor the type of buyers that do buy here, and it's a very wide range. It's quite a nice net to be able to catch if you are in the property industry in both of these towns, because we get young couples working in the vicinity, so working in Paarl, Stellenbosch, surrounds, Cape Town area. We get a lot of semigration, people that have sold their houses up north. They are not getting the prices that they have to get to be able to, for example, afford buying in Stellenbosch. So these towns are nice alternatives for them from a semigration perspective. And then people working, for example, in Cape Town, but they don't want to stay in town. They want a bit of space, a bit of farm feeling, a bit of countryside. So they choose to come here. And then also people who retire. Interesting enough, get a lot of retirees who wants to retire in a nice area, safe area, in a, for example, residential estate. Mm-hmm. But they don't want to overcapitalize on their retirement property, so it's also very attractive for them. So it's quite a nice range of buyers to be able to work with.
And let me just ask you a final one. What's the next frontier? So we've spoken about Wellington and Malmesbury, but at some point, they will also come into this wider net. What's next? What's after that?
Well, that's a good question. I think a lot of the surrounding towns are becoming so developed, they're kind of merging into one town. So I would think anything between Wellington, Malmesbury, the entire Boerland, Swartland section would be an area to watch. For now, yeah, I think that's the anything surrounding to Wellington, Malmesbury, once these towns are saturated, would be an area where people would look at.
Thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate your time today. And that's where we're going to leave our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.